Aiello, did you have any citations you wanted to give us on those two cases? You have to come to the center.
What I was referring to was QN 179 NJ 165. What happened in that case?
Just give us the citation. I don't want to extend the argument.
Oh.
We'll find it. Tell us what page.
Okay, there's a reference to the fact that the mother understood that.
Can you give us the page number?
Yes, at page 174.
Okay.
That she would be able to cut off the questioning at any time on behalf of her son. And then again on page 178.
And is there any other authority elsewhere for the proposition that we've discussed? Just if you could give us the citation alone.
That's what I was able to find just now. And again, that the mother knew that she was in the position to stop the questioning at any juncture in order to protect her son's interests. And from that, I
understood
that she would also then have the right to to stop the questioning from proceeding.
Okay. Mr. Munoz.
Good morning, Your Honors, or afternoon. May it please the Court. The interest of the ACDL in this case is preventing the erosion of the Fifth Amendment rights of juveniles in New Jersey, specifically as envisioned in Prussia and their progeny, or its progeny. To that end, the ACDL advocates for a bright-line rule. That is, when police summon the parent of a detained child to the police station, the police must give a meaningful opportunity for the parent and child to consult privately on the issue of whether or not to waive that child's Miranda rights. This case is a prime example of what happens when such safeguards are not in place. A parent is called to the police station, told that her child committed a crime, and without being told or advised as to her child's rights, is put in direct contact with the child, with police insisting on listening in nearby. As the public defender has thoroughly argued, this is exactly the type of action that is likely to elicit an incriminating response from a juvenile. And it is therefore the functional equivalent of police interrogation under Innes's plain meaning. Moreover, even if the police action complied with Prussia's bright line black letter law requiring that the police make their best efforts to obtain the parent's presence at interrogation of a juvenile, it undercuts the clear policies that motivate that parental presence requirement. The parental presence mandate in Prussia does not exist in a vacuum. It set forth the reasons for requiring police presence along with its progeny at these juvenile interrogations. The reason for a parent's presence is clear. They are there to serve as a buffer and crucially as an advisor as the child decides whether or not to invoke their Miranda rights. In this case, AA's mother was precluded from serving as her role as an advisor as envisioned in Prussia. The ACDL proposes the following prophylactic measure to ensure that in the future parents are able to serve their role properly as envisioned under Prussia. First, both the parent and the child need to be advised immediately of the child's Miranda rights. This is crucial because a parent can't advise a child on whether or not to invoke those rights if the parent is not aware that they exist. Second, and critically, the parent and child need to have the opportunity to confer privately regarding the decision as to whether or not to invoke the child's rights. This is easily implemented. It's simple. It's a small burden, and any burden on the state is significantly outweighed by the constitutional concerns at play here. Again, Prussia envisions a parent serving as an advisor, a legal advisor, to permit the police to listen in as this parent-child discussion occurs on these sensitive issues, would show the exact sort of frank discourse that is required in determining whether to invoke those rights. This is compounded where a child's statement may in fact be used against him or her in a subsequent criminal proceeding.
Do you really believe that it's the Prussia is talking about the parent functioning as a legal advisor? Because I think what you're talking about, you're suggesting a privilege here, and I see nothing in Prussia that puts the parent in the position of an attorney.
Under these circumstances, and under the prophylactic policy proposed here, it wouldn't be a privilege akin to necessarily the attorney-client privilege. It's more of a pragmatic approach. Because Prussia expresses this desire that the parents serve, not necessarily as an attorney or as legal counsel, but in a role where they can advise a child on the very discrete issue.
It's a parental role, it's an extension of the parental role, but you're not arguing that Prussia puts a parent in a legal in the role of a legal advisor, are you? Because I thought I heard you say that.
For the discrete issue, they're intended to advise the child on the discrete issue of whether or not to invoke their Fifth Amendment rights. So for that discrete issue and for that...
Counsel, isn't it really more to make sure the child understands the rights so that any statement that the child may make in the police presence is truly knowing and voluntary? Knowing and voluntary were the two touchstones that the court was using in the Prussia opinion, wasn't it?
That's correct.
And the mother or parent, whoever is able to be located and brought to police headquarters, is being brought there to help police ensure later on that they could be able to prove that any statement by a child was truly knowing and voluntary. So it's for the benefit of all.
Correct. And it's the ACDL's position that in order to truly ensure that waiver, if it occurs, is knowing and voluntary, that there needs to be some sort of private conversation between the parent and the mm-hmm. child. To have a police officer listening over the shoulder of one of the parties would really chill that sort of conversation.
What do you envision would occur during this private conversation? The child discussing with the mother what actually happened?
It's entirely possible.
Okay, so stop there. Is there a parent-child privilege? Does it exist?
No.
And if it doesn't exist, when the mother comes out of that private conference, can the police start asking the mother, what did your child say? And if they wave the child up, can the mother be brought before a grand jury and be compelled to disclose what the child said? Go ahead.
And that would be an evidentiary issue for if and when such a trial occurred. This prophylactic is simply to ensure that the parent is able to, for the discrete purposes of...
That's why I'm asking those questions, because the most simple approach is to make certain that the child is advised of his rights in the presence of the mother, so that the mother or the father or the guardian can advise the child whether or not to invoke the rights. Once we start going beyond that, it's going to create all sorts of other complications. Am I wrong?
I'm not sure how complicated it would be to provide that brief period of time
That's going to be fine, provided they're just talking about whether or not to waive. But look, I'll pass this along. I was in private practice. I represented juveniles, and when substantive discussions with the child was occurred, I had the parent step outside because of this very concern. And that's the reason why I'm raising it with you right now.
And perhaps a consideration of whether such a privilege should apply would be, I don't believe that's before the court currently, but that might be something that would need to be addressed further down the line. I think that in terms of effectuating that policy, it's fairly straightforward.
But if you assume that there is no such thing as a parent-child privilege, which doesn't exist in the law,
yes, Your Honor.
Are you still saying that private conversation should be part of the mix?
I believe that should be an option that is presented to the parties. I think it should be made available.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Only that any security concerns regarding that meeting would be easily addressed. The police address officer security issues every day across the state. They're able to do it quite simply. Security cameras, metal detectors, pat-downs. So such a meeting, in terms of logistics, would be easily achieved, even in light of any officer safety concerns.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Cohen.
May it please the court, good afternoon. This court, over the last two decades, really beginning with Prussia, has forged a jurisprudence of youth that has recognized young people's developmental immaturity and the unique vulnerability that that immaturity causes with regard to certain processes and procedures vis-a-vis law enforcement that might leave an adult similarly situated unmoved. Perhaps nowhere is that vulnerability more evident and more in play than in the context of custodial interrogations. We know that children are 2 times more likely to waive their legal rights than adults and submit to questioning. We know that they are far less likely to understand the meaning and the import of waiving those rights. And we also know that they are 3 times more likely than adults to make false confessions. And for those reasons, this court has taken the really extraordinary step with Prussia almost 2 decades ago to ensure fairness in the context of interrogations for children. Prussia recognizes these fundamental distinctions between children and adults and was intended, as I think all of the questioning today has made clear, to ensure that fairness in the interrogation process and to make sure that there are protections in place to protect children from the kinds of overreaching and the kind of misunderstanding that can happen during the interrogation process. But we now have 20 years of experience with Prussia behind us, and we've seen in cases like AS, in this case, in cases like QN, how those protections have played out and where the fault lines might lie. And so what the ACLU is asking today is that we take advantage of that experience and refine those and clarify those procedures to ensure that Prussia is continuing to accomplish its goal of fairness for children in police custody.
Tell us what those procedures should be.
Yes, Your Honor. So obviously first, that any time that there is an actual interrogation or the fundamental equivalent of an interrogation, as we assert there was in this case, that both the child and the parent or the interested adult, whoever is present in the precinct, be Mirandized. And that a valid waiver be obtained.
Okay, let me interrupt you there, and I'll obviously let you get to the second point. But you're talking about Mirandizing a parent. Miranda rights are addressed to defendants and to suspects. So this is a whole new concept of Mirandizing a non-suspect. Should we really be talking about that, or are we talking about having a parent present when the child is Miranda?
Yes, Justice Patterson, I'm sorry if
yeah,
I...
Okay.
So the parent obviously needs to be present.
Right.
I do believe that there, and I've taught my students this, frankly, I believe that there's a little bit of a hole in the doctrine with regard to what it means to have the parent present and what happens if there's a conflict between the parent and the child with regard to the waiver decision. I don't think that we have to reach that question today. It's not before the court. QN contemplated what might happen if a parent wanted to cut off questioning, but I don't think the question of what happens if, for example, a parent wished to invoke and a child wished to waive is before the court. AS, by the way, I think dealt quite clearly with the question of what happens if the parent wishes to waive and the child either does not or does not fully understand the implications of waiving. And so I think that that is well settled by this court. I think there's this one small open question, but again, that's not the question that's here
the
today.
The whole purpose of that opinion is to focus on the fact that it's the child's right to waive or not waive.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So that's
yes.
that's who has the Miranda rights.
That is
nobody
absolutely
else.
Who has the Miranda rights, yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Please keep going.
And then in addition, Chief Justice Rabner, the other question or the other piece of the protection is the opportunity for private consultation. And I understand, Justice Albin, your concern about privilege. I share it. This is one of the reasons that our brief includes a discussion of the what we feel would be the better practice, which would be provision of counsel prior to any waiver. But for our purposes today, in answer to your concern, what I would say is that that concern is always there. And as someone who also has spent decades representing children, I always inform the parent about the risks of remaining in our consultation, ask the parent to leave, make sure that the child understands that. The reality is that any parent could be subpoenaed at any time to testify in front of a grand jury about what a child may or may not have said, either in the precinct or at home or at the detention center. That's always a concern. I would join Mr. Munoz's veiled suggestion that we consider a child parent privilege. But again, I don't think that's the question that's before the court today. And I think that the advantages of providing for private consultation far outweigh that very meaningful and significant concern. Hearing no other questions, thank you all for your consideration.
Thank you. Mr. Murawski, rebuttal.
May it please the court, if I could maybe shed a little light on the permission question. There are various departments, and I think the department in this case does in fact have a policy that they won't interrogate without the parent's permission. And I think in QN there was a similar departmental policy to that effect. I don't think it has not been mandated by this court, however. In fact, this court has even said, even if you can't find the parent, well, you have to give a good reason why you couldn't find the parent, and that's part of the totality of circumstances. So you could even have an interrogation without the parent at all. It's just a heavy consideration in the totality. So permission is not required by
this court. So you think that's what was being alluded to in QN in the citations that you're
Yes, I think in QN the officer believed that the parent had a right to end the interrogation and needed the parent's permission. But my impression from that case, it was the officer's understanding. And that's fine if the department wants to have that policy, but that's not a rigid requirement by this court. Also, I want to address something the defendant said about complete control. The police did not exercise complete control over the situation. They had no control over what the mother would say. They had no control over how loud she would say it. They had no control over what the defendant would answer, the juvenile would answer. So this notion of complete control is a gross overstatement. They conducted physical control over the circumstances for very good safety imperatives. Also, the defendant insists that the police gave them details of the charge. I believe the record supports only it was a shooting on Wilkinson Ave. I believe that was the extent of the details. Now, it would be kind of rude for the police not to tell the parent at all why their son's been arrested and why she's been called. There should be some brief labeling of why he's there, but this is not a situation where details were provided to the extent of other appellate division cases where the police showed the suspect their entire file for 45 minutes. They just gave a brief description of why he was there. Also, the critical factor, the root of the inquiry, and this court has said it on multiple occasions, it's whether the suspect's will was overborne by police conduct. Now, it's very attenuated to say, well, the police allowed this and then they overheard it, so that's police conduct. But it is not the type of conduct envisioned by the Miranda line of cases. Certainly every case that's addressed this situation where the police allowed a wife or a parent to talk to the suspect None of those cases have found that it's the functional equivalent of interrogation. In those cases cited by the appellate division and the defendant and amici, all those cases had some direct police interrogation as a component. I believe I addressed that in my brief. In none of those cases was police interrogation completely absent, as it was here. So this would be a rather extreme extension under the circumstances. Now, the state certainly fully embraces the notion that if the police are going to interrogate, they have to give full warnings to the parent in the presence of the parent, and there should be an opportunity to consult. But in circumstances where that does not take place, the legal doctrines become a little bit more complicated, because the only justifications that will work under those circumstances is a separate warning requirement for the parent. That would be a radical extension of Miranda that's not supported anywhere in the country.
Not separate. No one's in the presence of the child.
Well,
the child receives the warnings in the presence of the mother, so they're both being advised at the same time.
Well, it's been suggested the parents should get telephone warnings as soon as they're notified, and this would be a rather extreme extension of Miranda. That should really not be considered. Also, if this court is inclined to establish new requirements, I'd like to remind the court of what it said in Prussia, that the police should be judged by the standards prevailing at the time the officers interrogated the defendant. Here, they didn't even interrogate him, but at the time of the incident, not by stricter standards announced in Prussia. So even if this court was inclined to go in that direction, it should not apply to this officer or this juvenile, and it should not apply to anyone in the appellate pipeline prior to the court's decision. The police officers were not put on any semblance of a fair warning that this would be required. In fact, quite to the contrary, to the extent there is case law and authority on the subject, they were told this is not the functional equivalent of custodial interrogation.
I understand why you would make that perfectly legitimate request. Are you suggesting to us that there are a number of cases in the pipeline where police behaved in this fashion?
No, certainly not, Your Honor. This is the only one we know of. But just to cover, to cover myself.
One last question about the record. When I read the transcript, it was not clear to me that the child, although he could see police officers, that he saw police officers that were clearly within earshot. Can you represent that that's true?
That the child saw them clearly within earshot?
Yes.
I think the representation in the record was that the mother was standing right next to the child and the officer was clearly visible, and the officer said that he could clearly see them, and it's reasonably inferred that he could clearly see the officer.
Because the child was seated on the bench. She was standing.
Well, of course, the child did not testify, but it's reasonably inferable from the record that where the officer stood in relation to the mother and the child, that he was clearly visible. It was like an open fence. There was not many walls between the juvenile and the officer at this point.
Okay.
The officer had a clear view of the interaction.
And the child could see him?
The clear inference is that he could. There was a clear line. If the officer could see, there was no like two-way mirrors. If the officer could see him, presumably he could see the officer at this situation, and the mother did not dispute that they could both see the officers nearby.
Okay.
So the clear inference is that they saw them. There was no secrets taking place here. This would be a different case if it was more secretive. The fact findings clearly support the officer. There's no need to disparage what the officers did here, even if there was a requirement. The officers were acting in the hustle and bustle of a busy police department. They were just trying to get through the workday. They were not choreographing some legal assistance from the mother. That did not enter into the facts at all. That should play no role. It should not be inferred. If something like that is going to be found, there should be some evidence of that. And there was no such evidence here. And that contaminated the appellate division's ruling. They felt the need to say that they used her as an assistant and then they eavesdropped. That is nothing of what happened here.
So there could be a difference in understanding about the Innis standard in this case, assuming there was no bad faith. Correct?
Sorry, Your Honor?
You're suggesting to us there's no evidence of bad faith in this case, and I understand that. There could nonetheless be a disagreement about whether the Innis standard was triggered.
Well, of course, the bad faith on the part of the officer is an important ingredient to that, because if they knowingly used the mother as their agent, that would cause an entirely separate issue, and we acknowledge that. But there also has to be interrogation. Now, interrogation would suggest some types of verbal communication, words or conduct. Just merely allowing somebody to do something is a rather attenuated extension of the definition of custodial interrogation. And I refer the court to the United States Supreme Court in Arizona versus Morrow, which said that's not custodial interrogation. There's another Fourth Circuit case I cited in my brief. There's a couple state cases. There's even other cases that were cited by the defendants that said that merely someone else asking questions of while the police are present, even if the police allowed it, is not the functional equivalent of interrogation. Now, if it's something else under the context of fairness, that could be a different opinion. But
we've never adopted Morrow. I don't know that we've ever even cited Morrow. And the other thing is, in this area of the law, we've turned to our own rule on self-incrimination numerous times.
We urge the court to follow Morrow, at least for the limited purpose that allowing someone to interact with a suspect while the police monitor that interaction for safety reasons should not be considered the functional equivalent of interrogation. And there's also actually an old case, I know it's old, In Re De Silowitz, which has very similar facts to this case, and it came to the same result. So we also disagree with Amiki saying it could be easily addressed. We don't know how easy that could be to afford this private conversation, so we ask that the court affirm the trial court's ruling. Sorry.
Thank you to all.